Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. In collaboration with the United Nations Food System Summit, we've launched the mini-series Laying Down Tracks. Today, for the second episode of the series, we'll be focusing our attention on the summit's second action track, which is dedicated to sustainable consumption. Joining me as co-host for the episode is author, speaker, and influencer, Tristram Stewart. Hey, Tristram, how are you doing today?
I'm just fine. Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me onto the show.
My pleasure. Thank you. Calling in from England, is that correct? Are you in Sussex?
That's right. I live in the Ashdown Forest. It's where Winnie the Pooh is from, but most importantly for me, it's where I'm from. And I live on a small farm here and surrounded by woodland and beautiful scenery. That's where I've had the great good fortune of spending the whole of lockdown.
That's not so bad. And yeah, that's a good conversation starter. Say you're from Winnie the Pooh, the location of Winnie the Pooh, not so bad. Hey, you know, I first learned of your work after watching the ZPZ, the 0.0 film on Netflix called Wasted. In that film, you used a pretty cool props of recycled materials to create a series of explanatory graphics, specifically the one around food waste, the food waste pyramid, in that you and Anthony Bourdain break down the problems of food waste and even voice over the history of the sandwich, which in itself was interesting. You've literally written the book on it called Uncovering Food Waste Scandal. So I thought for the purposes of our chat today, the chat about sustainable consumption, the waste that oozes from our food supply systems seems like a good place for the conversation. So Tristram, could you tell us a bit more about the food waste problem and are we making headway in dealing with food waste?
Such a good question. I start with the context. I think anyone who is familiar with this topic knows that the food system is the single biggest impact that humans have on nature. It's by far the biggest cause of deforestation today and historically. It's the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's by far the biggest user of fresh water. It's the main reason for soil erosion. It is essentially the biggest reason for the mass species extinction event that we are in the middle of. And therefore, the food system as a whole, as one of humanity's biggest environmental problems and biggest social problems, those nearly 1 billion underfed people in the world and that 2 billion who are part of the biggest public health crisis in the world, namely the crisis of overconsumption, they're all connected to this system and how badly it is actually operating. If you look for arguably the most egregious manifestation of that poor operation of the food system, food waste is a pretty strong contender. We waste at least a third of the world's food supplies. So a third of all of that environmental impact is happening for no good reason. It's happening for food that is just being left to rot. And this presents two really big opportunities alongside acknowledging the tragedy that that represents. The opportunities, I think, are firstly, reducing food waste is a pragmatic, low-hanging fruit that would allow us to reduce our environmental impact, as well as, in many cases, increasing food availability in places where it's most needed. At the same time, and for me, what's always been central to my concern around food waste is a very useful way of exposing the core hypocrisy at the heart of the food system paradigm, that productionist paradigm, the paradigm that says the way out of this massive problem is to double food production by 2050. Or increase it by 60, 70%, depending on who you're listening to, whether it's Cargill and Monsanto who lobby hard that this should be the global agenda to massively boost food production, but even venerable institutions like the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Now, of course, it would be great to produce that much food, but if that means doubling the environmental impact, of the food system. Clearly, that is a very, very bad long-term strategy. Indeed, it's the biggest single threat to long-term food security, because we will literally cook the planet before we get to cook any of that food. And so food waste is a really good way of saying, no, actually, we already have loads of food. We eat too much of it in rich countries. We waste a third of it. Let's start there on changing consumption patterns, including waste. You asked, have we made any headway? My goodness, yes. I've been campaigning on this issue for 20 years. I wrote the book on it a bit more than 10 years ago. Thereafter, it completely took over my life. I founded the organization Feedback Global, which took the campaign against food waste around the world. I founded Toast Ale. You know, this has become my life. And over those 20 years, the situation has changed dramatically. When I started, you know, supermarkets were sweeping the problem under the carpet. They didn't want anyone to know about it. Governments had more or less zero policies to address food waste. Public awareness was at an absolutely zero level. It was just no noise around this. The businesses that existed to tackle food waste were pretty much non-existent. It was just, it was a dead zone. It was this huge problem that no one was looking at. Now, you cannot be a big food company in the world without having a food waste strategy. Governments around the world have introduced increasingly ambitious legislation. Billions, literally billions of dollars now have been invested in both charitable solutions to the problem, but also, very excitingly, entrepreneurial, business-based solutions to the problem. And public awareness has skyrocketed. It's gone from one point in 2009, before our big campaign started in the UK, it was the 13th out of 13 issues that people cared about when they went to restaurants. A few years later, after some years of vigorous campaigning, it became joint first most important. And that is tracked not only by public awareness, it's tracked by actual food waste reduction. So in the United Kingdom, as a result of forensic examination of household rubbish bins over the course of the years since 2007-2008, we can say confidently that per capita British consumers have reduced their food waste by one third, which is still leaves two thirds to go. But as mass behavior changes on environmental issues globally are concerned, it's a really standout success story. Industry have reduced their food waste by a similar level. And so we do have, in some parts of the world, a measured and direct result of this campaigning and the change of attitudes to food waste. And we, of course, have the Sustainable Development Goal now, of which I'm an official UN champion, to halve food waste by 2030. We are a long way from there. The UK is the first country to get halfway to it, but a very, very great deal more work is required to get anywhere near achieving that target by 2030.
Well, first of all, great work and congratulations. Sounds like it's a long road ahead, but nonetheless, incredible accomplishments thus far. I read and I'd seen that, you know, explain that about 1.3 billion tons of food is thrown away, adding up to about a third, as you mentioned, of food grown for human consumption is being put into waste. In the U.S., we're terrible at this. 90% of food scraps going into landfill. Hopefully those numbers have improved. But if our only solution here is around those consumer habits and then really driving change towards forcing grocers and retailers and suppliers to be better about this, if the only solution for food waste sits between the ears, is it all about the narratives at that point and convincing more folks that the problem is there and it's possible to fix? And if so, tell us about some of those narratives that you're using. What's new? What's hot off the press to get people to realize how big of a problem this is and what can be done?
Well, I think since you asked hot off the press, it's impossible to touch on the answer to that without addressing the pandemic and all the lockdowns that have happened around the world. Now, I don't have a spiritual practice and don't meditate, I don't do yoga, but I do retrospectively see that all of my work can be seen through a lens of another kind of practice, and I've come to call it companionship. Companion is my favorite word in the English language. Com, its etymological origins come from Latin, com being with and pan being bread. A companion is somebody you literally share food with. And indeed, this word pops up in languages around the world. Copain in French, it means the same thing, with bread, friend. compañero in Spanish and Portuguese. In Greek, syntrophos means the same thing, with and food. And indeed, the sharing of food to build friendship, to build society, build community, is a universal human behavior. Every single culture in the world uses the sharing of food to build friendship. And indeed, it is a universal great ape behavior. Our closest animal relatives, the bonobos, proactively go and find bonobos to share their surplus food with. And particularly, they will prefer to share it with a stranger over and above a friend. They're turning their surplus food into social capital to make new friends. So when you mentioned those 1.3 billion tons of food that are wasted every year, I now think not just about the wasted environmental impact of that. I think of how many friends we could make if instead of throwing that food away, we found other people to share it with, whether that's the extra slice of pizza that we can't quite face eating in the pizza store, offering it to a friend or even a stranger, or whether we look at that geopolitically from the point of view of, you know, a consumer in the UK thinking of the food that they've got on their plates and how taking that food and then wasting it impacts on the global food situation, which it does in a direct, meaningful way. And so seeing this problem through the lens of, well, broken companionship and the need to restore good companionship into our food consumption happens, our food practices, our policies, our government policies, as well as obviously our own individual ones, I think is a really great way of unlocking the power that food has. Because I think not only is it the biggest problem, I think it is potentially the most powerful package of solutions we have for tackling environmental and social ills. The way in which you can use food and feasting, and you will have seen in that Wasted documentary that you mentioned, one of my main areas of activity has been organizing Feeding the 5,000 and meals around the world, where we feed 5,000 people for free with food that would have been wasted. It's a way of bringing people together and saying, let's celebrate this stuff and come together and enjoy it. And using that convening power of food to project an alternative to what we have with the food system, a food system that instead of destroying habitat, actually creates it. Instead of depleting aquifers, can replenish them. Instead of putting carbon into the atmosphere, it can actually harness the power of plants to suck carbon out of the atmosphere and put it back into the ground, which of course is what plants have been doing for billions of years. You know, we can use the food system to undo many of our big environmental problems at the same time as creating healthy, accessible food for everyone, in a way that is harmonious and in good companionship between humans and between us and the earth. And I think no better time to revamp the food system than now, when people have been feeling that separation, that lack of companionship. That, I mean, speaking for myself, the sharing of meals with friends is one of the things I have really missed over the last 12 months. And I look forward, in fact, I've planned a whole series of banquets over the months after June when lockdown in the UK ends, so that I can really live in that spirit of companionship again. And I think that power is one that we can unlock to reform our food system.
Well said. That is on point. Very, very well put together. And I love the idea of the spiritual relationship of breaking bread and using that engagement of companionship. So fantastic. I didn't know when you were saying that, though, on the spiritual relationship, you were going to take me to the soccer pitch and talk about Manchester City winning another title or something along those lines. But I'm glad you stayed on the food track. That was excellent. So thank you, Tristram, for that. Hey, let's start today's conversation here. So joining Tristram and myself for as guests in today's conversation for Action Track 2, our climate justice activist, Lana Weigand. Hey, Lana, how you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. And activist and law student, Webster Macombe. Hey, Webster, how you doing?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me.
And another macro trend that's connecting food and production, food waste, to the impact on the health of the planet. That effectively what we eat has become the best course of climate action daily. So is a sustainable consumption trend just in its infancy? And what can we expect to see in the future from this type of commitment, especially from younger generations?
Well, it's definitely not in its infancy in terms of sustainable consumption, right? Historically, a lot of diets, especially in the global South, have had mainly less processed and more plant-based foods. And it's just a matter of realizing that we have strayed away from that and that we need to go back towards a global shift to more of the less processed, more healthy, more sustainable consumption. And I think that's become more urgent in recent years, realizing where we are at with the climate crisis, especially that realization from young people and, you know, young people's mobilization that we've seen around the world through such as the Youth Climate Strikes movement and the ongoing efforts, even in the pandemic. And in coming years, I think that we can really see that shift being pushed, especially from some of the more Western high-income countries have more of the responsibility in being some of the countries that are currently consuming the most unsustainable, most harmful kinds of diets, you know, over consumption of meat and dairy, for instance, which is very environmentally taxing, and carrying more of that shift. But you can also see young people putting more of that pressure on governments and making more of that shift ourselves, just in acknowledging this connection between food, between our diets, and the health of the planet, as you said.
Tristram, I'll encourage you to jump in at any point you want with questions. I've got plenty of follow-ons here. So Lana, let's take that idea though of kind of scientific advancements and engagement and consumers have spawned that proliferation of plant-based proteins, as you spoke to. I know it's near and dear to your heart. So you could tell us what's happening there and maybe talk about the benefits and the concerns. You know, is this scalable for the developing world? Is it is this the prediction of the future that we're going to be, in your point of view, getting rid of dairy and meat completely? So how do you see that course of action coming together?
So the course of action that we're taking from the Food Systems Summit is acknowledging that we need this shift, right? That current consumption is not compatible with a safe level of global warming in which we have a livable climate in the future. So we need to make this shift towards what we know to be more healthy and more sustainable consumption. We are not by any means saying that we need to eliminate dairy, we need to eliminate meat, that animal food production needs to end immediately, right? We understand that there is a lot of difference between, for instance, indigenous food production methods and industrialized factory farms. And there's a lot of scale and range between that. So looking at what's happening, what's the most egregious, the most harmful, moving away from that, and also shifting consumption towards what can lessen the environmental impact, what is more compatible with a livable future, which we need for young people and for the planet.
I wonder what, in the context of, you know, the impending COP and of course, the Food Systems Summit, with the presence of the nation states of the world and them as key power brokers, what do we have to say to those nation state governments about creating the environment that helps people shift away? Because putting it all on us, of course, it's our responsibility. We can make choices, at least people in the relatively affluent world can make choices about what food they eat and how much of what kinds of food. And that of course, is a key target. But if you look, for example, at the $700 billion that are spent by nation state governments every single year on farm subsidies, only 1% of which at the moment is directed towards ecological farming and supporting a transformative food system. And arguably, it should be the exact opposite. Most of that public money should be being spent on addressing the public health crisis and the environmental crisis that food system is creating. But that requires the nation states. And I wonder if you have a hope when the countries of the world come together to look at the food system, to look at the climate, and hopefully look at those things together. What do you want them to do?
Certainly, the pressure is not all on individuals. And we need this action from member states, right? That's why we're here talking about the United Nations Food Systems Summit, is because member states are coming together. And that's a key opportunity for action, right? To actually galvanize this progress on food systems to achieve the sustainable development goals. And I think that member states really need to step up. From Action Track 2, we'll be offering a range of different kinds of actions that they could take. And it's the same for the other action tracks as well, right? Like offering them, these are some of the most game-changing, the most solutions with the most potential that you could take, that you could get involved in. And I also want them to not just take like the lowest hanging fruit or the easiest, most friendly solutions, but to actually think about the impact that they can make and see that they can be leaders also in this transformation. Because that's something else that I'm concerned about, that member states might, there are already some solutions that are coming across and with some more interest. For instance, things like school food is a more friendly area, right? As opposed to, for instance, putting taxes on meat or changing dietary guidelines or shifting subsidies, which are a little bit harder and take some more leadership. So I want them to really step up and challenge themselves in not just taking the easiest solutions from the menu.
Thank you, Lana. Great response. Let me bring in Webster here. We can talk a bit more about some of the work that he's involved in. So Webster Makombe is fighting to make nutrition a top priority for his government in his native Zimbabwe, where more than a quarter of children are stunted physically or cognitively because of a lack of nutrition. In his belief that there should be a dedicated nutrition department to help those most vulnerable in diet-related health issues. Webster, you've been quoted in saying that there's a problem where people mistake food security for nutrition. And there's plenty of maize out there, but the government is feeding children maize for one meal and then another. And then there's pumping out carbs into the children. So Webster, it appears that in order to have true sustainable consumption, then we have to also have layering in additional smart practices for some refined thinking. And for many reasons relating to human and planetary health, it can't just be about pumping out calories anymore. So this has to be about feeding our families or communities with healthy, nutritious, and mindful food. In Zimbabwe, how do you see opportunities to do this? And is this, you know, what's the best methodology to move forward? Is it a handbook? Is it infrastructure for finance and support? Is it legal coverage like you're getting in school? Maybe you could share some of the thoughts that are happening in Zimbabwe.
In Zimbabwe, one of the ways that I found to be quite helpful, and one of the things that I'm actually pushing to be put into practice, is tapping into our local food systems. Like, we have traditional food items and local food items that haven't been eaten for a while or are no longer part of the dishes that are being served. So tapping into those food items is one of the things that I think can do away with some of the nutritional problems that we have, because there isn't a lot of diversity. Like when food is being served, most people usually talk of a rainbow plate. You know, a rainbow plate, it has many colors and different types of foods, of which that is not the case. In most countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, one of the major reasons also being that, you know, food is not easily available. And that's why I was greatly thinking about tapping into our local food systems, because we do have food items, be it fruits, be it fruit trees, be it leaves, be it small grains, that can actually be used as food, but then people are not actually eating them. And one of the major problems, of course, would be lack of food sovereignty due to the post-colonial setup, where the food system that we have is kind of like a Western influence, especially now with globalization and TV and all those kind of stuff. There then is a social, you know, social status or social class that is attached to food, whereby if you're seen eating a certain kind of food, you're deemed to be poor. If you're seen eating a certain kind of food, you're deemed to be rich. Therefore, that then leads to a huge problem whereby, you know, a large number, large quantity of healthy and nutritious food items are sidelined, mainly because they're perceived as, you know, as poor food items. So I think this also goes into one of the issues that Tristan was talking about of food waste. So like it taps into the issue of food waste, not necessarily because the food is wasted when it's cooked or when it's produced or, you know, when it's manufactured, but also the main factor that we are not actually tapping into available food items is actually wasting itself, because these are, you know, these are resources that are available, but then we're not actually using them. So this is one of the major experiences that I have had in Zimbabwe, and especially at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic and when the first lockdown started, there was a major crisis of food shortages, because most of the food items that we would then have in our food system is heavily sustained on importation. So due to the lockdowns, most of the borders were closed. So, you know, the food couldn't come in as it used to be. That also is one of the major reasons why I thought we need to tap into a local food items for sustainability, because that's the only sustainable way we can move on from now onwards, because we can like seriously have a nation or a food system that relies on importation. And that at the moment that, you know, that trafficking of food is disturbed, if a nation then faces food shortages or hunger. Yeah, so those are some of the problems or some of the issues that I've seen in Zimbabwe. And on the government part, I think the government has been doing drastically well in terms of, you know, putting nutrition on the limelight in the most recent years, ever since we started working with the Scaling Up Nutrition Movement here in Zimbabwe, because now we set up a best reading room in Parliament, and also the First Lady is doing around the nation, doing cooking competitions whereby she's reintroducing some of the traditional recipes, some of the traditional foods that used to be eaten long ago, but then are no longer eaten now, and reintroducing those kind of recipes and food items. And I think it's a really good initiative. Yeah, So that's where we are in Zimbabwe right now.
Is your First Lady working on the optics side of some of those local food, as you mentioned, the kind of stigma tied to some of the local food being perceived as what the poor folks are eating? Is she engaging in part of that conversation to help change points of view?
Yeah, I think she's also looking into that, because for me, from my perspective, the whole idea is just to change, you know, the behavior around how people perceive a certain kind of food. But then you also see that although such kind of things are happening, and then she's all in those cooking demonstrations and then cooking competitions, doing such an activity is also being shunned by some people who, you know, who look down upon traditional food items and look at the whole activity as if it's, you know, it's not good or it's nothing. So although she's, I can say we are trying the best that we can to change the people's perception on traditional food, especially this food is made by smallholder farmers and comes from the most marginalized and rural areas. Hmm. Yeah, so but from my view, I think she's doing quite well, and slowly but surely we're gonna witness a social behavior change in the aspect of how people perceive food. And also on that note, it was quite exciting that just last week I was watching a Netflix social by this South African stand-up comedian. His name is Louis Ogola, and the special is called Unlearning. And he was talking about the lobster revolt, about how in the 18th and 19th century, lobster didn't used to be a high-end food that was served in restaurant and for the elite. It actually used to be food for slaves and prisoners. So that's also one of the things that I've really been talking about ever since I learned about that fact, that, you know what, even if people look at a particular food in a certain way, things will most certainly change. And that's what I'm actually focusing on right now, just getting people's perception to change, especially when it comes to traditional food items.
Huh. Great stuff, Webster. So let me read Lana's background here, and then we'll continue further with some of the conversations there. Webster, I want to come back to some of your specific work and how law may be able to help influence that. But Lana Vigana is a climate justice activist and voice of a shifting plant-rich food system as a climate solution. Lana is a UN Food Systems Summit vice chair of shifting to sustainable consumption and a zero-hour youth climate activist. So Lana, how have you found your work in DC to have influence internationally? Are you seeing similar trends domestically stateside that are influencing and having impact globally? And what lessons have you taken out of that?
The kinds of trends that we see in the United States are similar globally. And I think there's various reasons for that. One of them being that I noticed, you know, a lot of people do, leaders do look to the United States in terms of, you know, what the trends are here, what is happening. And I think that's especially true in moments like this, where we have a new administration that could really lead the way and that can really stand out, you know, on the international scale as well, when we have a little bit more focus coming to the United States and a great opportunity for more climate action and also action on food systems in turn.
Definitely hope is there as far as connecting food systems to general human health and then planetary health. I think that's, as an American, I can speak to this and say, we have a lot of opportunity to do better here. So I'm excited and enthused by getting back on a global stage as well and see what kind of influence can happen. Trust me, you actually talked about some of the trends in the U.S. in your TED Talk. You were talking about the abundance and excess in the country, like the U.S., where we produce four times the amount of food that's needed to feed ourselves. Is that, again, going back to that mindset of evolution of food waste or just perception of what a broken system looks has to be redefined to become, are you seeing that type of influence stateside move in a different direction? Are we realizing our problems and trying to lead around the world of a better solution?
Yeah, that's the key parameter. Just a small clarification, what my data demonstrated is that the US has available to its population, including indirectly through nutrition that is fed to livestock, up to four times the amount of nutrition required to feed the population a healthy number of calories. That is not the same as talking about production, which is independent. That's food availability. So if you look at the food in shops and restaurants that is available for consumption by humans, in the US, it's twice as much in calorific terms as is required for a healthy diet. And in all rich countries in Western Europe and North America, we have a surplus of between 1.5 and 2 times the nutritional requirements, calorifically speaking, in our shops and restaurants. And then that four times is looking at the maize and the soy and those other crops that are grown and fed to livestock, but which could have being used to feed humans more efficiently directly if we were all following Lana's preferred diet of being much more plant-based. And so the reason why I think that data is so important is going back to what I said at the beginning, which is that the core problem here is the productionist paradigm. And at the heart of that, what we have to acknowledge is that we have a food system globally that is increasingly and already massively dominated by the corporate system. In other words, the primary driver in the food system, ironically, is not to feed people. If you were designing a machine that, or you know, a system that had the primary objective of providing nutrition to humans, plus one would hope within ecological limits, because obviously in the long term, if you don't operate within the long term, within ecological limits, that's not only a disaster for the environment, it's also a disaster for all the people and their nutrition. So if you were designing a system to feed people, it would look very different from the one we have. The primary driver in the food system is not that. It's the production of maximum financial return for the shareholders of the corporations that run the food system. Now, those two don't have to be misaligned. You can govern a corporate structure in such a way that whilst delivering financial returns to shareholders, it also performs the other functions effectively. And good governance systems all over the world allow corporates to, for example, provide water and sanitation, transport, and of course, food, these public necessities, whilst governing them in such a way that they do it in an efficient way that is fair for everyone. But we also know there are huge areas of corporate practice that where the ecological and social needs of people and planet are not being met, whilst a corporate system strips the world of its assets, both social and natural, and makes a tiny profit. And I'm afraid the food system is a real classic case of that. So we see corporations ripping down the Amazon rainforest to grow food that is massively subsidized to produce more maize, more soy, more meat, more dairy, which again creates a public health crisis. I mean, you couldn't design a system that was doing more harm if you tried. And yet we allow this to continue, indeed to grow, and indeed put in policies to help it to grow further. And that is a very, very unhealthy situation, I think. First and foremost, in our package of solutions, we need to look at how that corporate structure needs to be properly governed in order to prevent the most egregious ills of the food system. Is the US leading on that front? I'm afraid it is not. If you look, I mean, I mentioned farm subsidies as one example of this. The farm subsidy system in the US is the most backward of rich countries. If you contrast it to, say, for example, how the European Union has transformed its, it's still got a long way to go, mind you, but it no longer is directly incentivizing overproduction in the way that I'm afraid the US still is. And these are really, really core issues. And if you look for what, you know, why is there so much obesity within the USA? Why is there an ecological catastrophe on farms across the USA? Why is the junk food system so healthy in the USA? All of these come down to that corporate-led, government-enhanced food system. That said, of course, there are some great green shoots. There is a vibe, as always in the US, there is one thing and its extreme opposite, living happily side by side. If you look for instances of entrepreneurship creating great, vibrant, healthy businesses, the US is also a really good place to go and have a look. If you look at, say, for example, the dozens of companies in the USA that have popped up to tackle the problem of food waste. I mean, take Imperfect Produce, my dear friends there, who actually met, two of the directors met at the Feeding the 5,000 we did in Oakland back in 2014. They just sold their company. I think it's worth a few hundred million dollars now. And it's just been selling ugly fruit and vegetables to hundreds of thousands of Californians to help tackle the food waste problem, as well as making healthy fruit and vegetables more affordable to more people. And, you know, that is the kind of entrepreneurial vibrancy that that you also find in the USA. So I would say the US has both the most egregious examples of catastrophic policy, appalling corporate practice, and also some of the great examples of what we need to encourage and invest in.
Yeah, there you go. You nailed the long game that we take in the States is break it so badly that we'll create an entrepreneurial opportunity, and then a bunch of young smart folks will come in and fill that void with things that they believe in. So, hey, it's working. There you go. It's exciting evolution. You know, maybe one thing, I think, as you had mentioned, Tristan, that would be a interesting conversation, especially for this forum. You had mentioned that 1% of subsidies currently goes to ecological farming. Well, imagine if we get up to 10% with that, something that's feasible for an organization like the UN or member states to partake in actually changing the subsidy structure to get back to investing in ecological agricultural infrastructure, investing in soil and ocean health, things that will actually have lasting change on improving nutrition, health, and surrounding environments. That would be, there's something that there's a kernel to go from.
I think absolutely. I mean, I do not exaggerate. I think if you look at one area of policy that has the biggest impact potential for the environment and society in the world, of any policies anywhere, it is the agricultural subsidies. Here we have taxpayer money, public money, that is already being collected. No one's complaining about it. Unlike if you try to introduce a carbon tax, for example, most populations in the world wouldn't be having it. And that's why we don't see it happening. This is a tax people are already paying. They are budgets that governments are sitting on, and they are currently being grossly misallocated. Hmm. Using that money to, for example, pay farmers to sequester carbon into their soils through well-established practices that are both good for soil health, good for fertility, good for soil water retention, as well as sucking carbon out of the atmosphere. There is no area that I think is more powerful for using existing resources to use known techniques to tackle a global problem. I think that is such a key opportunity. It should be right at the top of the agenda for what we ask nation states to do, is reallocate, you know, I would argue much more than 10%. Yeah. Most of farm subsidies should be tied to good ecological farming practices.
Hey, Webster, you know, we'll need some good attorneys and good lawyers to get us there. Is this something of interest? Are you looking at, as you get your law degree, of looking at farm subsidies and working with federal governments, whether it's in Zimbabwe or more generally, about where we allocate those resources and what's the impetus behind it?
Yes, that's something that we have already started looking into, and something that I'm really passionate about. Especially like when we go for, say, conferences or high-end meetings, I always try and hang around, MPs and legislators, just to use my law student experience to see how best we can use the legislature to influence, you know, food systems, and also how we can just make legislation that speaks directly into food, either be it how it's eaten or how it's made. And also, as a Scaling Up Nutrition youth leader for nutrition, we also have one of our partners, a law firm that works in the UK and the United States, that are actually partnering now to look into how best we can deal with the issue of food law. Yeah. So we started working with them, I think, sometime in March. Hmm. So I think the initiative would be coming out later on. But as a law student, this is one of the major things that I really look into, just to see how best the legislature can play a role when it comes to food systems. And I'm glad to say, like in 2018, I was in the UK and I met some parliamentarians from the British Parliament, and we set up the APPG for nutrition, because they didn't have an APPG for nutrition before. So me and Bo May, a youth leader from Cambodia, we came and then we talked to the MPs about the importance of nutrition and how, you know, the legislature and their roles as, you know, as policymakers and lawmakers, how they can play a role in getting nutrition financing, or just making, having laws around nutrition and food security being made. And then we are able to set up the APPG, and I think it's been running for two, three years now. And at the Scaling Up Nutrition Global Gathering, I was also part of the cohort of, you know, of MPs that were looking into how best we can deal with the issues of nutrition. And the Secretary General for the Inter-Parliamentary Union, Martin Chungang, was there as well. So these are some of the examples of how I use the stuff that I learned in law school, especially about the law and how best the law can be used, you know, to shape people's lives or to make people take a certain route. And for me, that's basically looking into food laws and stuff like that. And I'm really happy to say, for instance, in Zambia, they really set up a good example, because they enacted a Food and Nutrition Act, which is something that really really think is important. And I think there's a first of its kind in Africa. I don't think there's any other African country that has a specific act of parliament that speaks into food and nutrition. All the other countries only have policies. So I also think that's a good thing if we shift away from policies and mainly focus on laws and legislation. Because the good thing about an act of parliamentary legislation is that it does not give you the choice to do or not do what it says. Once something becomes law, you have to oblige by the law at all costs. Unlike a policy you can either choose to implement it or not implement it. So which is why I think having food laws is really it's really important.
Well, keep up that great work, and we'll need your talents moving forward. So thank you for all you're doing there. Lana, I wanted to give you the last chance, the final word here, as you are the UN Food Systems Summit's Vice Chair of Shifting to Sustainable Consumption Habits. What can we expect to see from the upcoming summits, the conversations, the many summits that are moving forward from the UN, where food is such a major underpinning and we, the consumer, need to evolve with the reality of planetary boundaries and the reality of a new food system. So what can we hope to see coming out of the food summit, and where should we look moving forward?
As the main outcome from the food summit, we're of course hoping to see major action, especially from government and world leaders. But aside from that, I'm also really hoping that the food system summit will bring these topics that we're talking about to larger attention around the world and drive that also into other upcoming summits, such as COP26 this year, the United Nations Climate Conference, and making that connection in raising the issue of global food systems, such as food waste and food consumption, to larger focus and how that connects to issues such as climate change, biodiversity, and other upcoming United Nations conferences as well, and also drive action in those areas. And something else that I'm really excited about is that there's a youth-led effort around the Food Systems Summit this year, in which young people in Act for Food, Act for Change are having a pledge to get 1 million signatures from young people by the summit, and to really drive forward the demands and energy of young people to the Food Systems Summit and beyond.
Excellent work, and thank you for everything that you're doing there. This is going to be an amazing summit, and I look forward to seeing the fruits of the labor coming forward. So, and Tristan, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. Really appreciate it, and sharing such insight and wisdom here with myself and a listening audience. That was excellent.
Thank you so much for having me. Great discussion, and great to meet you, Lana and Webster. Thank you so much for your work that you're doing every day. It's really, really inspiring and gives me hope.
Well, thank you all, and I'll just say until next time.